Hello, mother. Hello, father. Here I am at Camp Granada. Camp is very entertaining. And they say we'll have some fun if it stops raining.
Alan Sherman's novelty hit about a boy trying to get out of summer camp came out 50 years ago this summer. The song has a happy ending, a fitting one for our guests today on Focus. Psychologist and author Michael Thompson says summer camps provide a valuable opportunity for children to socialize and make decisions away from their sometimes overprotective parents. And Katie Nolan watches kids grow up in her job as a camp director for two Girl Scout camps in central Illinois. Plus, there's your own personal stories about summer camp. And for those, we welcome your calls and emails. I'm Jim Meadows. A summer camp edition of Focus is coming after the news. Jeffrey Hardy. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Whether it's day camp or sleep away, out in the woods or focusing on a sport or musical instrument, summer camp is an experience shared by children across the globe, and our guests today have examined them in detail. Psychologist Michael Thompson visited several summer camps in writing his book, Homesick and Happy, How Time Away from Parents Can Help a Child Grow. It was published last year by Ballantine Books. Thompson argues that a summer camp offers a setting where kids can begin separating from their parents and learn to find their way in a way that helps them to begin to formulate their adult identities. Dr. Thompson, welcome to Focus.
Thank you, Jim.
Also joining us today, Katie Nolan. She is the resident camp director for two Girl Scout camps here in central Illinois, Camp Tapawingo and Camp Piers. They're in the Peoria, Bloomington, Normal area. Katie, thanks for joining us on Focus.
Thank you.
And Michael, in a nutshell, what's the basic valuable experience that kids can get from a summer camp?
Being away from your parents.
That's it.
I'm talking about sleepaway camps, and it's not that I'm against day camps. Heck, my son is a counselor at a day camp this summer and has been for the last 2 years. But sleepaway camps provide a chance for children to leave home, to go out and experience their own challenges, and most importantly, to have psychological ownership of what they do. When your mom or dad is looking over your shoulder, or even standing at the sidelines of a town sports team game, it's not completely yours. You really have to get away to know that it's your life, your adventure, your challenge, and your triumph.
And that's not possible if you're coming back to mom and dad at night?
That's not possible, not in the same way, no.
I'm just wondering, because I do remember in the far-off 1960s that, especially in the summer, I never went to summer camp, but I spent a great deal of the day away from my parents.
And but that's not happening anymore.
Why
children
is...
The greatest change in American childhood in the last 20 years has been the death of free, undirected neighborhood play. Parents are too frightened to let their kids play for hours. I mean, I will ask an audience of people in their parents in their 30s or 40s, how many of you played for 4, 5, 6 hours on a Saturday without checking in? And it's the vast majority of them. And I say, how many of you now let your children do that? And it's just a sprinkling of hands. People don't let their children roam, have adventures, form their own groups. The American parents are very frightened. And so the kind of thing you're describing, Jim, which I also had, both in the summer and in other seasons, I could go out on weekends with friends, that's pretty much lost to American children.
You're seeing throughout the country, throughout a whole lot of demographics and parts of the country, that is the case? It's been that total?
Well, even walking to school, 30 years ago, 80% of American children walked or biked to school, and that's down to 13%. So most kids are with either their parents or adults or in adult-supervised activities almost all of the day. And parents now are dedicating themselves to going to all of their children's soccer games or ice hockey games or lacrosse games or whatever it is. And partly it's because they're the chauffeurs. But they the parents are thinking, our presence always adds value. And I wrote Homesick and Happy because I wanted to say very gently and through a lot of stories to parents that your presence doesn't always add value. Actually, the kids who make friends at camp where their mom doesn't know the other child's mom, that's a special friendship because the child herself owns that friendship.
Katie Nolan, you're a camp director at a couple of camps in Central Illinois. Your season, I take it, begins in a few weeks?
Yes, it does. We're right around the corner.
Well, tell me, the experience that Michael Thompson is talking about with children really having their parents hovering over them, do you see that experience happening?
Absolutely. A lot of times today's society's technology has influenced the way that our parents parent. And they have the ability to check their kids' grades and see what they're doing constantly. They have cell phones. They know where they're at all moments. And that idea of just kind of being a kid and being free doesn't really exist for a lot of them. And so at camp, they have that opportunity to basically just be a kid. And for parents, when we work with them during this time of the year, as they're getting ready to send their kids, you can tell the anxiety is there as, you know, they've signed their kids up and they're sending them off to stay with people they don't really know and in a program that they may not have done as a child. So it's definitely relevant and definitely something that, you know, we have to take extra care with our parents today.
Michael, I was wondering if you go in further as to how do the skills and how do the things that kids need to develop away from their parents, how does that work out in a camp setting?
Well, what gives children confidence and self-esteem in life is to have developmentally appropriate challenges try new things and then surmount them and succeed. So I go to a camp in Ontario, a canoe camp, and the kids come back from their first five-day canoe trip. They're out away from base camp for 5 days. And they come back, these are 11-year-olds, and they all stand in a line and they talk about their trip. And they say, oh, we were portaging between these two lakes, and then we got stuck in the mud, and so-and-so lost her shoe, and we had to dig in the mud, and we had to dig down in this bog to get it, or then we were on the lake, and there was this thunderstorm and lightning, and we had to paddle like crazy to get to the shore to be safe, and then we tried to light a fire, but it was raining too hard, and we had a cold dinner, and then there were mosquitoes, and then our sleeping bags got a little wet. And what's amazing about these kids is that they're all standing there looking radiant, looking powerful and strong and happy. But what they're talking about is facing discomforts, discomforts that most parents would have tried to protect their children from. And the parental end, look, I'm a parent and a grandparent. I get the whole wanting to protect your children and grandchildren. It's built into human beings. But when you're constantly protecting them or even comforting them in discomfort, it reduces their capacity to know what they can handle. And when you go off to camp, you may do something that's scary. I did as a camper. And as later as a counselor and instructor at Hurricane Island Outward Bound, I saw a lot of kids through scary things. And when you master something that's new, that's challenging, but not overwhelming. That's why I always say developmentally appropriate. It's up to the camp to make sure that they're not overwhelming kids and just terrifying them. But when you meet such a challenge and overcome it, you get a feeling that your parents can't give you and your school can't give you.
Katie Nolan, perhaps you could talk about the activities you have over at the camps that you oversee. What sort of challenges are devised for the kids out there while keeping it appropriate for their levels?
Well, just like Michael said, a lot of it depends on the age level of the kids and what kind of challenges we'll give to them. But for our youngest campers, sometimes the biggest challenge is just being away from home and being in a new environment. For our older girls, we do horseback riding, we do high ropes courses, we do travel camps that actually leave the state and go backpacking, kind of like the canoe trips you were just talking about. And so a lot of it just kind of depends on where the kid's ready for. And we offer about 7 different types of camps during a week. And so there's lots of options for the kids to pick something that they're comfortable with and the parents are ready to let their kids try when it comes to their camp experience.
So how challenging can it get?
Well, our most challenging camp that we have is a 2-week backpacking camp, where the girls are backpacking this summer. They're heading up north to our Wisconsin Girl Scout neighbors and up into Michigan and to the Great Lakes, and they're actually backpacking through Porcupine Mountains and islands and things, and they're kind of off on their own for 2 weeks. And so that is probably the most challenging camp that we have for the girls.
Michael, I'm wondering, does it have to be the traditional out-in-the-woods camp to get the sort of valuable experience you're talking about, since I'm seeing a lot of other camps, a lot of camps, say, built on specialized activities or special needs, et cetera. Can these also work in the same way?
Yes and no. I have a friend who works at the University of Michigan, and there are lots of summer camps that run on the campus of the university. And he said to me, and this is sort of inside talk from camp people, he said to me, about half of them are real camps. And, well, what does he mean by that? From my point of view, camp is a psychological experience. When camp is too much like school, when it's just basically skill training, it's classes all day, and it's, you know, it's seat time, that's not different enough from school. But for me, and I write this in Homesick and Happy, that camp is an experience of community and of character. That is community because you have to live with people. You have to share a cabin. You're changing clothes. You're respecting each other's privacy, but you're also invading each other's privacy constantly and working that out the way you would with brothers and sisters at home is part of becoming a community. Eating the camp food, singing the camp songs, sweeping out your cabin or cleaning up your tent, or if you're out in the wilderness, making food together. This is a community. I mean, if you go out on a hike that Katie describes for 2 weeks and you don't help cook, excuse me, and that's why I say it's both community and character, because it will challenge you. Your mom will fix new stuff for you. Your mom will make your bed for you. Not a camp. You have to reach down and do what everybody else is doing, and you have to do it 24/7. And that is a challenge to the character of every child. Do I have it to be a meaningful, productive member of the community? There are a lot of one-week skill training programs, which for me don't have any emphasis on community and don't ask a lot of kids' character. And for me, they're training programs rather than camp.
Well, let me, since we're on the subject of, and you mentioned camps that are situated at university campuses, I wanted to say hello to someone who's in charge of a program of camps at the University of Illinois here at Urbana-Champaign. On the line now, Shelley Mix, are you with us here on Focus?
I am.
Good morning, Shelley, and I understand that you are the program coordinator at the Office of Public Engagement at the U of I?
Correct, and we have a website called engage.illinois.edu/summercamps where you can find out more than 25 summer camps that the university offers that will keep children's bodies and minds active this summer.
Our Michael Thompson was talking about camps like these as ranging from camps which were like specialized training programs and some that were more like the traditional summer camp experience. Do the U of I camps run that gamut?
We do. We have very traditional summer camps, specifically our sports camps, at baseball, basketball, cross country, you name it. There's a lot of sports that the university offers. We also are affiliated with 4-H, and so there's 4-H camps out in Monticello for students. But then there's also, as he mentioned, kind of the more skill-building type camps, archaeology, architecture, engineering, math. I mean, it's a university. You can imagine the gamut. But even some of those skill-building camps are residential. For example, our architecture camp is a 2-week residential camp. So I would argue that I think maybe it's the best of both worlds. Some of it is seat time, but they take field trips to Chicago to view the architecture there. There's a lot of activity, even though it's more of a trade.
Okay. What age groups are you talking about with the various camps that you offer?
Our camps start as young as age 3. University Primary School offers one at age 3, as well as the Spanish camp start at 3. Our camps go all the way up to college age. As you can imagine, a lot of the skills are high school age, so they lead right into college.
I'm wondering about camps which have names here like, you know, Media University, and which doesn't sound like exactly, you know, sitting around the campfire sort of stuff.
Correct. Yeah, there are plenty of those, too. So I guess, you know, it's a big university, and we have the full range. Media University is a new one this summer, focuses on advertising, journalism, media studies. And it's really, as their description says, it's looking at viable career choices through hands-on learning activities. So that certainly probably doesn't have a campfire involved.
Okay. Something along the lines of a specialized camp might be something like the wheelchair athletic summer basketball camp.
Absolutely, yes. We do have a lot of those. The ones on our website, there are some specialized ones, but the vast majority are open to both genders. Some of the sports camps are limited to males or females, and there's only one or two other camps that are limited, as far as I know. For example, the games camp is girls adventures in math, engineering, and science. That's limited to girls. There's another one in engineering just for girls, but most of the camps are open to anybody.
And I'm looking at the 4-H Memorial Camp, which you host, in their website, and it does look like the sort of traditional camp activities. It's a sleepaway camp. Kids stay together in cabins with a counselor. I see people, I guess she's kayaking over there, but she's definitely in the water.
Yeah, so 4-H is certainly the most traditional summer camp. That's the only one of the camps that I know of that isn't hosted here in Champaign-Urbana. The other, I guess, more along the traditional lines would be our sports camps, because they are overnight and they are very physically active, obviously focused on one sport. But they are in the residence hall, so you do have that sense of community and you are with a leader and you do have kind of your cohort of other campers.
This brings up the question of how much do these things cost? And if you're a parent who's never been to camp or sent a kid to camp, you just may be wondering what sort of price ranges we're talking about here.
Yeah, actually, we have one camp this year that's new that's free. We have a philosophy camp, so that might be a lot of seat time.
Philosophy camp.
Yes, and that's actually, there's no cost for that. Most of the more academically oriented ones offer scholarships, so I would encourage anybody, if your student, if your camper has a certain interest, you know, architecture or archaeology or engineering, and you think you can't afford it, at least contact the camp and see what's available. Sports camps, unfortunately, there's a lot of NCAA rules. They really can't offer scholarships for those, but for like I said, a lot of the academically oriented ones, there are scholarships, and it ranges, I mean, really from free all the way up to, we have one that's focused on human rights. It's a new program through Global Studies, and that is in like the $1,000 range, because the students actually get one college credit at the successful completion of the camp. So,
and perhaps more in the average phase. I'm looking at the 4-H camp. It's a one-week program, and its fee is $195.
Right. I'd say, and $100 to $300, I think, is pretty average.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for talking with us about the programs. Shelley Mix with the University of Illinois, about the programs available through the U of I. Again, what is that website?
It's engage.illinois.edu/summercamps.
And I believe there should be a link to that on the page for today's focus program at will.illinois.edu. Shelley, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And we are talking about summer camp here on Focus today with Michael Thompson, author of Homesick and Happy, How Time Away from Parents Can Help a Child Grow, and with Katie Nolan, summer camp director for the Girl Scouts here in Central Illinois. And we also hope to talk to you. I noticed we had a caller, and he left us, but we welcome him back. If you went to summer camp as a kid, If you ever worried about your kids while they were off at camp, did you ever work as a camp counselor, whatever your memories or questions, call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu, and you can also send them through social media at Twitter or Facebook at Focus580. Michael and Katie, I'm wondering, I brought up the price because when you're talking about the joys of summer camp, they're not free. What's realistic to expect, and for how many families is the summer camp they need actually obtainable? Michael, if I could.
Katie, you want me to go first?
You're welcome to. Go ahead.
All right. Well, Girl Scout camps tend to be very reasonable because they're reaching out to a broad range of kids. I've gone to camps. You said, Jim, at the beginning that I'd gone to several camps when I wrote my book. I went to 21 camps, and I continue to go to more and more camps to do staff trainings. And I go to some very fancy private camps that are very expensive, that sometimes, $1,000, $1,100, $1,200 a week. These are expensive camps, as expensive as private schools. I also wrote about a camp down in Texas for kids with HIV and AIDS that was completely free. One of the girls who campers there said it was a piece of paradise. And all of those kids who go to Camp for All in Texas are sponsored by people who want children with serious illnesses to have the camp experience. One of the things that we know is that all children can benefit from the experience of leaving their families. Over the years, I've worked with kids with diabetes, and occasionally you get a teenage boy. I'm the psychologist at an all-boys school in Boston who doesn't want to have diabetes, doesn't want to test his blood sugar, doesn't want to take his insulin, and gets very angry and resistant, as we say in psychology, and there is nothing that is better for him than to get away from his parents, who are constantly on his back about it, get away from everybody, but go to a Joslin diabetes camp where everybody in his cabin has diabetes. And it's life-changing. Even sick kids, the getting away from their parents, getting away from the kind of medical monitoring. Now, they are looked after medically at a diabetes camp. But the principle is the same, that suddenly they have their ownership of it, and they share it with everybody at the camp. And that goes back to my sort of benchmarks. Is it community building, and does it have an impact on character? I, in my book, tried to look at camps a wide range. I went to a camp in Vermont with the spectacular name of Camp Downer. Makes everybody laugh when you say I go to Camp Downer. But it's in Downer State Park in Vermont, and it was the gift of one of the first environmental philanthropists in Vermont history who left his farm and property to the state of Vermont. And they run a camp that is, they proudly call the cheapest camp in Vermont. Which is $315 a week, and they managed to get some scholarships for kids whose family can't do that. And they have waiting lines forever for Camp Downer. I think if you care about the idea of camping for children, you can go to different organizations and find a camp that will give your child some support, or a camp you can afford.
Katie, if I could check with you with the camps that the Girl Scouts provide in Central Illinois, what sort of price ranges are you talking about, and do they have to be Scouts to take part?
Our price ranges probably would say range fairly average to what we were talking about, somewhere between about $150 for a week up to the $700 for our travel camp. the one I was talking about before. And actually, many girls will just join us during the summer to do our camping programs. We've kind of hit a point with our camp cycle where we have tons of girls who are in the junior high, high school age bracket, and they aren't active scouts. They have 1,001 things to do. We know kids are overbooked these days, but they still want that experience. And so they'll just join us as scouts just to do camp during the summer. So by all means, you don't have to be an active scout to be part of the program.
Michael, you talked about parents hovering over their children. Do they worry about camp?
Oh, yes. Worried parents worry about everything, and so it's often a really big psychological risk for a parent who has not herself or himself gone to camp to send a child. In fact, I go to areas of the country where it seems crazy to them to send children to camp, but when you explain the premise to them, They get it. You know, one of the things about camp is the relationship between older kids and younger kids. Our children go to very age-segregated schools. You're stuck in third grade. You're stuck in fifth grade. You don't get to spend much time with middle schoolers, and certainly you don't get to spend much time with high schoolers. And I think initially it scares parents that their children, their 11-year-old children, might be looked after by 19-year-olds. But that's a game-changer for an 11-year-old, is to spend 2 weeks with a 19-year-old, a college student, who's really looking after her and playing games with her and having fun with her and teaching skills, and because it all of a sudden opens up a world for children of older kids as teachers. It's not just middle-aged people, the way you find in school. And look, I work in schools all the time, and I'm beyond middle-aged myself. But you know, we're at a point right now where we overvalue what I would call systematic education, and we undervalue the intuitive teaching, the inspiring intuitive teaching of older children for younger children.
Katie, Nolan, I understand before you were a camp director, you were a camp counselor.
Yes,
working
I was.
Directly. How old were you when you were working with the girls?
I started when I was around 20. I was never a camp kid. That's kind of a rarity in that aspect. It was just one of those college things that I was going to do before I graduate, and just kind of randomly picked a camp in Kentucky and started working there. So it kind of just fell in my lap.
What was it like working with these younger kids? And I take it they were anywhere from like maybe, you know, 8 or 9 in the teen years?
Actually, the girls range anywhere from about 5 to 17, so it's a little broader range. And initially, because I hadn't been a camp person before, I was kind of terrified going into it. But much like we talk about the campers growing by being put into new situations, the staff do just as well. And so I really obviously fell in love with it, being that I'm still doing this. But it was really rewarding watching the kids come in at the beginning of the week and be apprehensive, and the parents who have to tell you every little detail about their kid that they think is important that you know, to seeing those kids at the end of the week become so confident in whatever skill they're working on that week, whether it be boating or horses or just being at camp. It was really rewarding seeing that happen.
Yeah, I take it there's a lot of one-on-one between you and the kids then.
Yeah,
as a counselor, that is.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Being a Girl Scout camp, we have safety ratios we have to meet that kind of dictates the girl-to-child ratios. But it's very important to have that personal relationship with their kids, to know who they are and what makes them, you know, excited and happy and sad, and kind of, much like a parent, be able to know how those kids work.
And was there particular training that you had to undergo as a counselor?
Absolutely. It's pretty standard for camps to have about a week of training before their campers show up, again, speaking for overnight camps. That is something for parents definitely to look into if they're looking at camps, is to ask the director what their training is. Typically, it's going to cover first aid, CPR. It's going to cover age level development for the kids they're working with, special needs training if they serve those kinds of kids. So it's definitely something for parents to ask about if they're considering camps.
Okay.
Can I say a word about counselor training, though?
Yes, Michael.
I think counselor training starts when you're 10, 11, 12, if you're a camper. Because
I would agree with that, Michael.
Most camps are looking for the kids who are going to grow up to be their counselors. Mm-hmm. And I work in a lot of wonderful schools, and including some very fancy independent schools. And I've never seen a school that does the kind of deliberate leadership training that summer camps do. You know, college admissions people go nuts when they realize they've got a camp counselor who's applying out of high school who already has experience taking care of small children, because they know that here is a young person who is more or less hand-selected and groomed to be a leader of younger kids, and then given real responsibilities. You know, when you're a camp counselor at 17 or 18, you very often have what is essentially life and death responsibility for children down at the waterfront. There may be, in fact, a waterfront director who's a true grown-up. But everybody who works with children is taking enormous amounts of responsibility. And the thing that struck me most when I was visiting camps was how a high school kid who might be regarded as kind of young and irresponsible, and particularly boys, you know, 17-year-old boy, what's he good for? You give him some meaningful responsibility. In a day camp, you put him in charge of 8 or 9-year-olds, and he's responsible then for the day. And it grows the younger kids up, but it grows the bigger kids up very fast. And both my daughter and my son have done it. It's been a huge part of their leadership training is what summer camps have provided them.
It's time now for a short break. We'll be back with more about the summer camp experience. This is Focus on WILL. We're back on Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows with psychologist Michael Thompson and camp director Katie Nolan as we talk about summer camp and what it does for childhood development. And we're looking for your summer camp memories. Give us a call at 333-9455 or call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL or 1-800-222-WILL. You know, Michael and Katie, thinking of one of the things that's changed over the years as to how people feel about summer camp, I'm looking at the American Camp Association website. And Michael, I understand you're a former board member of the ACA?
Yes, I was. I was out of touch with camps for about 25 years, and then a camp invited me to do some training with their staff because I do a lot of teacher training during the academic year, and I got reinvested in camps, and I saw a different kind of kid than I see in school. I go to 40 or 50 schools a year to do student assemblies for kids or to do teacher training. But I was seeing a more playful, more creative, freer kid than I was seeing in school. Kids who were making up their own campfire skits, kids who were teaching each other songs and rhymes. And I was seeing a part of childhood that made me nostalgic, because I think it's dying off, that kind of free play and children teaching other children things. And so I began to be more interested in camps, started to work at more of them, and eventually the ACA invited me to sit on the board, because I think the ACA was dealing with the fact that you can't persuade parents anymore just to send their children to camp because it's fun. They think they have to send their kids to programs in the summer that enhance their skills, that look good on the college resume. I think the fundamental reason to send your child to camp is not because for the college resume, although I mentioned that earlier. It's because of the growth and development. I think it's a very powerful growth experience. And I bet Katie sees it every summer with kids who come in timid or frightened or a little, who are kind of followers in a school setting, who just get their feet under them and take some risks and are much more bold in a camp setting.
I want to go ahead to a caller standing by on line one, Suzanne from Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus.
I'm what you'd call a real oldie. I have 65 years since I went to camp. I went summers for 8 weeks. And we did all sorts of activities, and I think it probably was one of the best things that ever happened to me in my life.
8 weeks at a time?
Yeah.
So that's a couple of months away from your parents.
That's right.
What do you remember? What really stays with you from those summer camps?
Well, I couldn't possibly enumerate them all. Socializing, learning to get along with others. Essentially, I was sort of an only child. My brother was quite a bit younger than me, and it was my first experience with a whole bunch of people my own age and wonderful counselors. And I look back on it with great appreciation.
And what do you remember your parents feeling about it at the time? Michael telling me that, you know, there's a lot of apprehension among parents today. Did you feel that your parents were being a little apprehensive when they sent you off to camp for 8 weeks?
Well, you want an honest opinion?
Yes.
My mother was an avid golfer, and my dad worked very hard and was on the road. And I think that they sent me to camp mainly so that they didn't have to entertain me at home.
So it was more time off for them during the summer as well.
Exactly.
But Suzanne, you said it was a life-changing experience for you, that something happened for you at camp, which you've carried with you for all of your years.
That is to not just assume that somebody wasn't going to be likable because you didn't like the first impression they made.
Oh, so it was really learning to get along with people in that intimate day-to-day way.
Yeah, because I was more or less an only child.
Right.
And I didn't have a whole lot of siblings to bring me up short, and I didn't have a whole lot of neighborhood friends. And the ones that I could have made friends with, my parents didn't approve of. So I went to summer camp, and I think as much as anything to get me out of my mother's hair.
Huh. And then your parents couldn't tell you whether they approved of your friends or not, because they were just at camp.
Yeah, that's it. I went to three different camps. Two of them were wonderful. One of them closed, so I went to the other one by the same people. The third one, I lasted a week and a half. And I called. They called my parents and said, please, come and get her.
Wow, that's a big difference.
Well, yeah. I was apparently allergic to something at that camp.
Oh.
And
but it wasn't that, being your third camp, it wasn't that you were overwhelmed with homesickness at that
camp. Oh, no, or that I didn't know what camp was like.
Right.
And I spent a week in the infirmary, and the camp nurse finally said, all right, call her parents. She's not going to have a good summer.
Right. But some factor X, you still don't know what it was you were allergic to.
No, I have no idea.
Right.
I have various allergies at various times still. But that's, I have.
You know, I wrote in Homesick and Happy about a mother with a child with multiple allergies. And the mother was so, so nervous. She had medical training, and she'd been, she had the EpiPens, and she was always worried in it. And she was always over this kid. And he wanted to go to camp. His friends were going to camp. He wanted to go to camp. She sent him to a Camp Seagull down in North Carolina. And he didn't know it. The little boy didn't know it, but his mom was staying in a motel down the street. She couldn't leave him at camp and go home. She was down the street. But he came back and wrote a fifth-grade essay about how that was the first time in his life that he began to feel like he could take care of himself and manage his own allergy. He was sitting on a dock with his feet in the water when he saw a jellyfish, and he thought, whoa, maybe I'm allergic to that. And my mom isn't here to tell me. And my doctor isn't here. I would have to manage, if I were allergic to that, I'd have to manage it on my own. And he came back to school and wrote an essay about what a turning point that was for him in his life. You know, it seems so obvious to me that parents can't give their children independence. At a certain point as a parent, you have to step back, open the door, and let them go out to become independent. And that's what camp is for many kids.
Suzanne, I want to thank you very much for calling in. And let's go over to another caller on line four, Barbara in Bloomington. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Oh, thank you. I had the opposite kind of experience in camp. This was a long time ago, and I think your information about generational changes is probably very relevant here, because when I went to camp, I was very put off by the regimentation of the camp. When I've talked to people who went to boot camp, I thought, oh, well, I guess that's what it was, because it just seemed like every second of every day was scheduled and unpleasant in one way or another. And I guess the difference was that at home, we just played in the neighborhood. It was the baby boom generation, and we had plenty of socialization and plenty of independence, and we got to camp, and it was quite the opposite. I guess my experience in camp is that I learned to absolutely despise camping, and
that's the outcome I would wish for. Barbara.
You know, you couldn't pay me to put a backpack on my back and sleep in a pup tent and, you know, endure the horrors of the outdoors. And I just, you know, I still have fantasies about how I could have corrected that situation, because I the fantasies are mostly how I could have escaped from the camp, you know, run away. And
why did your parents send
you? I never wanted to run away from home.
Right. Why did your parents send you this sort of military-style camp?
Well, they were church camps and 4-H camps, and, you know, they weren't for very long, thank goodness. They were a week or two in the summer, and I don't think my parents were trying to pawn me off on somebody else, because at home they weren't, you know, hovering over us in any way. So
did
I don't know. It was
did
just
they
a,
want the church indoctrination or the 4-H skills?
What
did they? What were they hoping you would get out of it?
I don't know. I'm sure it was a financial sacrifice for them, but
they must have had some form. Well, it sure didn't work, did it, Barbara?
No, it sure didn't.
I hate hearing these stories, but I know they're out there. And there was a military tradition in camps, but at both after World War I to toughen kids up, and as approaching World War II and immediately after to give kids a kind of a semi-military experience. That is mostly gone. Though I do consult for a boys' camp in Vermont, where the only relic is that the boys line up in the morning and to watch the flag being raised, and they shoot a little cannon off, a little toy cannon. And the boys love it, and you get turns shooting the cannon off. But the girls' camp across the lake, whenever they hear the cannon, they always say at the girls' camp, oh, they shot another boy.
Barbara, thank you very much for calling in with your experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Take
Bye.
Care. And Katie, that makes me wonder how structured are things over at Camp Tapawingo and Camp Pierce?
Well, there's a couple different philosophies on how to set up a camp. I personally run more of a decentralized camp, meaning that I put the girls into groups that we call units, and they have their own counselors, And a group of them kind of take off in camp and do their own thing for the week, make their own schedules independent of everybody else as that little group. Some camps are more of a centralized camp where a lot of wives follow this program where it's more about the individual child. And the child makes their own schedule. They want to do archery, they want to do crafts, they want to do canoeing. They do that independently of a group. And so for the camp that I run, it's very much based on that little community group of about 15 to 20 girls and their counselors who get to kind of create their world for a week. And our camps, if you look at our descriptions, are about a paragraph long that say, this week you're going to do X, Y, and Z. Every week is a lot longer than a paragraph. And so one of the things that girls do when they get there right away is actually make their schedules for the week, and we find out what do they want to experience while they're there. So it's very much driven by the girls and that kind of group decision process.
Well, I'm wondering, Katie, if you come across a child at a camp who is really not having a good time, who is really disliking the experience, do you find that it can still be salvaged, that things can be set right, or are they just stuck with it?
It kind of just depends on why they're not having a good time. I'd said earlier that we have about 7 different camp programs running at the same time. So sometimes, you know, if mom signed them up for an art camp and they do not do art and they hate art and they're stuck there because mom put them there, if there's a bed in another unit that's like the boating group and they really want to do that, we'll check with mom and just switch them over to another group. And sometimes it's as simple as the solution needs to be. But like I said, it kind of just depends on what the problem is that they're facing.
Michael, what have you found out about that as far as when kids who are not having a good time in camp, what are often the factors, and can a camp experience still be salvaged?
Oh, yes. I think if you make friends, the activities don't matter all that much. The Kills camp directors hear me say that the program, these beautiful programs they set up, don't matter.
They don't matter at all.
I think it's the relationship with the other kids you meet and the relationship with your counselors that is really at the heart of the camp experience. And whether it's her, my daughter, Joanna, when she went off to camp, was very interested in horseback riding, and she'd been doing it at home. And we paid an extra premium for her to go. Horseback riding's expensive. And she went for a month, and when she came home, I said, so how was the horseback riding? She said, I didn't do it, Dad. I said, well, what do you mean you didn't do it? We paid extra money. She said, I didn't like the counselor. I said, well, what'd you do instead? Thinking about my money having flown away, right? She said, I sailed. And I said, oh, well, why? She said, I love the counselor. Mm-hmm. And my daughter Joanna will still to this day say she's the best sailor in the family. Absolutely true. And she developed a relationship on her own, which was really important to her. Now, the question is, does your identity as a child come from going through the activities your parents picked out for you, or does it come from exercising your own will and saying, I want to do this, I don't want to do that? And Thomas Saz, a great American psychiatrist, said, you know, our identity is often formed by what we choose not to do. And that's what my daughter did. So I'll tell you one more quick story, if I can.
Yes.
About my son, I sent him to my old canoe camp. At the end of the second year, he said, Dad, this is your kind of camp, not mine. And he said, I get the camp thing, but this isn't my kind of camp. I said, what do you want, Will? And he said, I want to go to an arts camp. So I found him an arts camp, and he went there very happily and became a counselor and learned to be a woodworker. He's now in art school, finishing up art school next year. And that camp had a huge impact on his life. He now teaches woodworking to kids at a summer day camp in the Boston area. But he had to tell me, not this kind of camp. And I wrote a piece about it in one of my books called The Right Camp for My Child. You partly don't know what's going to be the right camp until the kid gets there and says, no, not quite right. But what I found interviewing hundreds of kids at camps is they said, I said, what's the most important thing about camp? And they say, well, you can be yourself here. And to me, that's an identity thing. This is my life at camp, and I think that's the overwhelming experience.
Well, I want to thank both of you for coming on Focus today. We're just about out of time. Michael Thompson, who has written several books on childhood development, is also the author of Homesick and Happy, How Time Away from Parents Can Help a Child Grow, about the summer camp experience. It's published by Ballantine Books. And Katie Nolan is a resident camp director for the Girl Scouts Camp Tapawinko and Camp Piers in Central Illinois. There's links to more information about both Michael Thompson's books and about the Girl Scout camping program, as well as other camping information. Go to our website for today's show at will.illinois.edu/focus. And Michael and Katie, thank you very much for being on the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus. Tomorrow on Focus, if you're looking for a career, you may find it in translation. There's a growing demand for people who can translate written words and interpret spoken ones into other languages, with extra points for those who understand the cultural nuances of different societies. Tomorrow, we'll talk with Elizabeth Lowe, who heads the Center for Translation Studies at the University of Illinois, and Tarina Bell, owner of In Every Language. And that's a company that provides translation and interpretation services. And that's coming up on tomorrow's show here on Focus. We're live every weekday at 10 o'clock and replayed at 8 o'clock on AM 580. And you can always listen to the show streaming at will.illinois.edu. Go to will.illinois.edu/focus for an archive of years of past Focus programs. Focus is produced by Lindsay Moon. Other members of our Focus team are Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Cronick. Jason Croft is our technical director and handles your calls. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL.